Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. The new program is designed to cultivate leadership and entrepreneurial skills while empowering each Carthage student to shape a custom career development plan from their first days on campus. Learn more about the Aspire program at carthage.edu/aspire. My thanks to Troy McDonald for being guest host on today's morning show.
Welcome to the morning show with Greg Berg. Obviously, I am not Greg Berg. He is off today. I am Troy McDonald, and I am here today with Nan Calvert, who is from the Root Pike Watershed Initiative Network, for her monthly program here on the morning show. We are pleased to welcome Dr. Doug Tallamy, who is a professor at the Department of Entomology and Wildlife Ecology at the University of Delaware, to talk about native gardening and why it is so important. I've learned so much already in our conversation before the show, Nan. So, Nan, talk about Dr. Doug Tallamy and why you wanted him on the show today.
Well, there are a number of reasons. I wanted to start off 2020 with something empowering, something really positive, because as people who love plants, every time we put our shovel or our trowel in the ground, it comes with great power, the power to change things for the better. And I know that a number of our listeners already incorporate a goodly amount of natives into their landscape, but there are not nearly enough people who do that yet. So we tend to navigate towards or gravitate towards ornamental plants or horticultural species, because that's kind of what most of us know about. Unfortunately, at this point in time, or maybe fortunately, because it really does support native landscaping, we can't really continue with these vast sort of human-centric landscapes anymore, because they're not relational. They're not life-sustaining in the way that we require them to be. Dr. Robin Wall Kimmerer uses the word reciprocal when she talks about the natural world. We need reciprocal landscaping. In other words, not only do humans benefit from it, but everything else in the landscape, our native plants, insects, mammals, reptiles, amphibians, birds, the whole nine yards benefits as well. We have so much acreage vegetated with turf grass that just doesn't do anything for anybody. And everybody, no matter how small your lot is, everybody can do something in terms of putting in a native plant. So that's what we're going to talk about today, how native plants are the underpinning for everything. I don't want to take over Dr. Tallamy's time, but that's why I wanted Doug Tallamy to be on with us today.
Yes, and kind of I want to take a step back here and Dr. Tallamy, you know, talk about why this is important. Why is this something that we should be concerned about? And then kind of how you kind of began your research in this area.
Okay. Well, first, thanks for having me on. This is a really important issue. Why is it important? Wow. It's important because all of life on Earth is the energy that keeps life on Earth chugging along comes from the sun, and that is captured by plants, and it's turned into food through photosynthesis. But if the plant doesn't pass that food on, then nothing else that depends on that plant can exist. And this is where we run into problems with native versus non-native plants. Wherever you are in the world, native plants are much better at supporting life around them, because the life around them has figured out how to get the energy from those plants. So when we start bringing in plants from Asia or South America or Europe, particularly our insects are very poor at acquiring that energy. And if you eliminate insects, then you eliminate the food that keeps our birds and so much of our wildlife going. Insects really are the core of our most of our food webs. So that's why native plants are important. You need them to support the food webs that support the vast biodiversity around us. And a lot of people might say, well, who cares about biodiversity? We care about biodiversity because it's the plants and animals around us that run the ecosystems that support us. So humans are not separated from nature. We are part of it. And without functioning natural systems around us, we're not going to make it. So these are critical issues for our own well-being. We can be very selfish about it. We cannot continue to design landscapes that degrade local ecosystems. We have to have landscapes that enhance them. And if we do that, then we're sharing our spaces with the rest of life, and the prospects of a sustainable existence on Earth are much brighter. I forget the second part of your question. Oh, how did I get interested in this? I'm an entomologist. I was trained in classical entomology back in the 70s. One of the things we learned was how important plant-insect interactions were and how specialized they were. About 90% of the insects that eat plants can only eat particular plants for which they have developed the adaptations to get around all the way that plants defend themselves. Plants really don't want to be eaten. They want to capture the energy from the sun and use it for their own growth and reproduction. So they defend their tissues with nasty chemicals. And only the insects that can get around, circumvent those nasty chemicals are the ones that can eat those plants. And that takes long periods of coevolution with particular plant lineages in order for that to happen. So the monarch butterfly is a perfect example. It eats milkweeds. And it's very good at getting around the toxins in milkweeds. And milkweeds are quite toxic plants. But in doing that over the eons, it hasn't spent any evolutionary time getting around the defenses of oaks or cucurbits or cherries or anything else. So now it can only eat milkweeds. And that works great as long as you have milkweeds around. But if you take milkweeds away and replace them with a zinnia or something from someplace else, the monarch can't eat it, can't develop on it, and then you have no monarchs. And that's true for 90% of the insects that are out there. So I got interested in this when we moved into a new home in Pennsylvania on a plot of land that had been mowed for hay before we moved in. But it was thoroughly invaded with plants from Asia, the typical invasive species that we have in this area. And I noticed, well, our insects are not eating those plants, but they are eating the native plants. I thought it'd be a good research project. And it turned out to be something that other people weren't really thinking about. And it's turned into 12 years of active research documenting the extent to which these non-native plants have really destroyed local food webs. I better stop there.
No, that's great. I want to talk about kind of why, I mean, as you said, Nan, at the top, that, not enough people are doing this. I want to talk about why that is. You were telling me before the program that it's been known for years about the kind of native plants, especially in Wisconsin, that they've been documented forever. What's in the way of people looking at those books, looking at the research, and just saying, yep, this is a native plant. I'm going to go ahead and put that in my lot.
Well, part of it is that we're just not taught it. When we go to school, we don't get any of that unless you then develop an interest in it at some point in time, and then you enroll at UW Stevens Point, and you get a degree in wildlife ecology or biology or botany or whatever, and that's a shame. And so, unless and until our school curricula includes that, just like they include reading, writing, and arithmetic, things are going to be very slow to change. I think part of it, too, is that we are inundated with it in the media. And, from a standpoint of, kill the crabgrass, kill the dandelions, kill this, kill that, kill the grubs in your lawn. And we tend to view native landscapes as frightening and insect-ridden in a negative way. We have to have a sea change. We have to have a major mindset change in order to really get the vast majority of homeowners or landowners to incorporate natives in their landscapes. The other part of it is it's extremely easy to control horticultural landscapes or ornamental landscapes. Many of them are just annuals, and so you plant them and they die, and then you go buy them the next year and they plant them and die or whatever. And it's not as easy necessarily to control, if you will, native plants. However, even a small plot for planting can have natives in them, and because we have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them to choose from here in southeastern Wisconsin, and you can make it as controlled and designed as you want. It's a myth that it just has to be wild and freeform. Many of us who love native landscape like the natural look. We like the wild and freeform because it's diverse and it's attractive to so many things, birds and insects and so on. But you can make it a lot more controlled and designed if you want to.
Dr. Towne,
can I add to that?
Yeah, absolutely.
There are two other reasons we should think about. One is that we've forever had this idea that humans are here and nature is someplace else.
Exactly.
There was never the idea that we actually could or needed to share our spaces. So we design spaces that are pretty, that are safe, that are essentially barren, and feel very comfortable in those. And then nature's happy someplace else. These days that doesn't work because there's very, very few someplace else's in existence. So that's one concept that we want to change. We want to think about people sharing our spaces with the life around us, because we need, for example, pollinators. We need pollinators everywhere, not just in our parks and our preserves, because it's the pollinators that keep the life around us, keep the plants around us in existence. So sharing is one concept that we need to think about. The other one is that we've thought forever that plants are just decorations.
Right.
And that, of course, the media has pushed that. You buy something that's pretty. We go all over the world looking for the prettiest plants, and you're just going to decorate your landscape with them. We haven't thought about the vital ecological functions that plants need to play everywhere. So that's, again, if we can change that mindset and think about, we're going to choose a plant based on what it looks like, but also based on what it does. That will help people change their basic designs. So Nan's right. Nobody's been taught this. So and you continue. You go to the nursery. You get the same old story. So that's why change has been slow. Although I will say, I've been talking about it for at least 10 years now, and I do see change happening.
Yeah.
So we are making some progress.
Right. Wisconsin has been very lucky for a very long time, at least, oh my goodness, gosh, it's 2020 already, for at least about 40 years or so. We have quite a number of native plant propagating nurseries in our state. And so while they might not be necessarily 10 miles from your house, we do have many, many choices in terms of sourcing native plants, whether they're in containers or they're seeds. And it can be forbs, which are flowering plants, or grasses, sedges, woody species. And I know in other places it's not quite so easy, but as Dr. Tallamy said, it is changing.
You know, it's interesting. I'm a millennial, as some people know. and really, I think that I did not know any of this, I'll be honest. But some of the only interactions I get with flowers and plants is on Instagram. And one of the big trends right now is like roses in a box, where they will ship them to you. They smell really nice. And then they ship them to you. And it's like a gift. And so I think that's so true that most people think that they're decoration, mm-hmm. that they're just there. But I also want to touch on something you mentioned, Nan, in our early conversation, that this is something that has gone on for, you know, hundreds of years, especially in America, with settlers coming in and bringing plants from their homeland, from their motherland. Kind of talk about that this goes way deeper than just, just buying something at a nursery, that this is something that was descended on us
Sure.
for many years.
So when Europeans, I bristle at the word settled, but when Europeans landed here, they brought with them things from the motherland. You know, they didn't know what they were going to encounter. They didn't know what the plant life was here. And so they brought a lot of plants that they used for food, for medicine, for dyeing clothing, and for textiles and all kinds of things. Some of those plants just didn't make it because it the conditions weren't right. Some of the plants made it, and they haven't caused trouble. Other plants not only made it, but now we are, in this sort of fight for our lives in terms of our native species to combat plants like garlic, mustard, buckthorn, honeysuckle, and a whole slew of other ones. And now, of course, we're facing more modern invasions like Japanese knotweed and, I could go on and on and on. So it's really important that when people go and buy plants, they have some idea of what they're buying, because what you put in the ground may have long-lasting impact. And so when Troy and I were talking earlier, we were talking about the Japanese barberry bush. It's a low-growing shrub. It's become ornamental, and you can control it really easily. Small thorns. But it's become a huge problem in the eastern region of the United States in terms of what it's done to forest ecology. So, plants travel. They might travel slowly, but they do travel. So, we do have Japanese barberry sold in nurseries here. So you have to, you have to be very careful about what you're buying and have some idea. You can't just go buy it like you buy a knickknack for your home. It, as Dr. Tallamy said, plants have an impact, and we have to go beyond just using them as decoration.
Dr. Tallamy, you've given lectures, as you've noted. You've been talking about it for more than a decade. What have been some of the surprising questions you've gotten from individuals and people who might be encountering this, like me, for the first time, this concept?
Surprising questions. There's not too many questions that surprise me anymore. I'm trying to remember what used to surprise me. I guess one thing that was a little disappointing was recognizing from the questions how little ecological understanding the U.S. public has. Mm-hmm. And again, it's not their fault. They were never taught it. As a matter of fact, there's negative connotations associated with tree hugger. If you like the environment, there's something wrong with you. It wasn't part of our core curriculum, and people have entered adulthood without any knowledge of how this planet works. So that's not all that surprising, but very disappointing, and something that we absolutely have to turn around. I talk about being stewards of the planet, but think of the big picture. As far as we know, all of the life in the universe, and certainly all the life we're ever going to interact with, is right here on planet Earth. This very thin film we call the biosphere surrounds the Earth. If the Earth were an egg, that biosphere would be thinner than the eggshell. And that's where all the life is. Well, we've cut that up into private land ownership. Tom owns this, Dick owns this, Harry owns that, and Mary owns this. Okay, but along with that land ownership comes the responsibility of stewarding all the life in the universe. And I can't think of a more awesome responsibility than that. So when people start to realize that, they're astounded, and they realize, hey, I really have an important role here. If I'm gonna own part of the Earth, I've got to take care of it, not just for the other creatures and the plants, but for ourselves. Because again, we're not going to exist here if our ecosystems collapse through lack of stewardship. I guess that doesn't answer your question about surprising questions, but there's some tough questions. One of them always has to do with ticks and Lyme disease. Mm-hmm. Because people think, well, if I put plants in my yard, I'm going to have more ticks and then I'll get Lyme disease. Not necessarily. The tick issue is a big one, and it's important. But the reason we have too many ticks with Lyme disease is because we've got too many deer, which are a critical part of their life cycle. When I was growing up in New Jersey, there was no Lyme disease. There were no deer ticks. I mean, there actually were, but they were so rare you never saw them. And they didn't carry Lyme disease. But there also were no deer. I mean, there are very few deer. So we let the deer population explode. It is around my house, it's 14 times over the carrying capacity. It's eating all the understory of our forest. And it has fueled the explosion of Lyme disease. So the ultimate way to control Lyme disease is to control our deer population.
Yeah, and I think...
You can. Mm-hmm. Yeah, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that's I've heard that in conversation with people who say, I cannot do this because I don't want to get ticks. I'm afraid of getting ticks. I'm afraid of getting Lyme disease. And you're saying that no, that it really is a measure of the deer population, not necessarily the plants that...
Well, Lyme disease is real. It's out there. But there are ways to minimize your exposure to it. You know, I talk about cutting the area of lawn in half. We've got an area of lawn the size of New England right now. And if we cut that area in half, that's more than 20 million acres of habitat that we could create. But the lawn you keep should be manicured. It should be mowed. And that is where you walk. These swaths of lawn, that's where you walk in your yard. You're not going to get ticks there. You get ticks from vegetation that's wiping up against your legs. There are times of the year when tick infectivity is greatest, and that's the spring, May and June, and then it falls off dramatically. And here's a tip that I got from a doctor who studies Lyme disease at the University of Pennsylvania. If you get a tick, a deer tick, dog ticks are not as near of a problem, but if you get a deer tick, pull it off and put Neosporin right where it was feeding, and do that two or three times. And that kills the Borrelia, the Lyme disease organism, before it gets into the your capillaries. And ever since he told me that, I've actually had Lyme disease five times. So I know about it. It's real. But ever since I heard that tip, I have not got any more Lyme disease. That works really well. Now, I'm not a medical doctor, and you didn't hear that from me, but it's so easy. Just put on Neosporin, and you can reduce your infectivity that way. But, you know, the alternative of paving over the world so we don't get Lyme disease, that's not an alternative. It's not a viable one. We cannot kill off the rest of life. Here's another product that works. It's called Daminex. It's these cotton tubes that are soaked with pyrethrum, and you put them out in your yard, and the deer mice that are the other part of the Lyme disease cycle collect the cotton, bring it back to the nest, and it kills the ticks on them. Huh. And it doesn't hurt the mice. So that's an effective way to combat it, too.
Wow.
But spraying your entire yard and killing everything is just not a viable alternative.
Right. And so often we approach the world like that, you know, and especially with regard to insects in our immediate habitat. I'd like you to talk about caterpillars for a while. Why are caterpillars so very important to the survival of our bird species?
That's a good question for a number of reasons. And this, you know, we didn't know this when we started out, but we have learned through our 10 years of study that caterpillars comprise the vast majority of the prey items that are brought back to the nest for most of our terrestrial birds. So 96% of our terrestrial birds in North America rear their young on insects, not fruits and berries, and not seeds. That's a key point. On insects, and most of those insects turn out to be caterpillars. A couple of reasons. Caterpillars are usually soft and juicy, so you can stuff it down the throat of your babies without fear of injuring them. They're relatively large prey items. One medium-sized caterpillar is equal to the biomass of 200 aphids. They're nutritious. They're high in fats and proteins, and they are the best source of carotenoids, which are really important components of vertebrate diets. Vertebrates don't make carotenoids. They have to get them from plants or something that ate plants. And caterpillars have far more carotenoids than any other type of insects. So they're just really, really good food for our birds. And in a healthy ecosystem, they're common, which is good because our birds require thousands of caterpillars to rear one clutch. A clutch of chickadees takes 6,000 to 9,000 caterpillars just to make one clutch of little birds that are a third of an ounce. So having an ecosystem that produces a lot of caterpillars is actually vital to maintaining those food webs. And that's why putting a plant like buckthorn in your yard that makes almost no caterpillars, that's why it's destroying the food web. Your chickadees or the other birds can't reproduce in a yard with no caterpillars, or with very few. They need a lot of caterpillars.
Well, for those of you who have just joined us, you are listening to The Morning Show. I am not Greg Berg. I'm Troy McDonald. Greg will be here tomorrow. We are here with Nan Calvert, who is from the Root Pike Watershed Initiative Network, for her monthly program here on The Morning Show, with our guest, Dr. Doug Tallamy, a professor in the Department of Entomology and Wildlife Ecology at the University of Delaware. Let's say I'm sold. I've listened to you both. I'm sold. I want to get started. Where do I get started planting a native garden in my land? What are the considerations that I should take into place? Can you do this as a renter? Do you have to be a homeowner? I mean, what are the different options that people have?
Well,
you want to start, Nan?
Sure, I can do that. You know, here in Wisconsin, it's really easy. If you're in the Racine and Kenosha area, one of the easiest things that you can do is contact our local Wild Ones chapter, which is the Root River Area Wild Ones chapter. You can always give me a call or send me an email. I'd be happy to help you get started. And, of course, Root Pike Watershed Initiative is a good resource as well. You can go online, but you need to be careful with that because not all websites are created equally, and they may mislead you unintentionally in terms of what's native and what's not. For example, in our area, our coneflower is pale purple coneflower. That's our native coneflower. But a lot of people put in purple coneflowers, which are beautiful and lovely, and they are a native plant, but they're not native to this area. And they tend to try and outcompete our native coneflower, which is pale purple coneflower. So there are a lot of extremely reputable sources for native plants and where to get them. So all you have to do is give me a call and I can help you out. And then, of course, once you decide that you want to have this native landscape, you have to prepare an area to receive it. You can't just sort of go and dig a hole in your turf grass and plant it and expect it to survive, because, you know, turf grass can be rather invasive, and you need to give native plants a leg up. They have a lot of things against which to compete. So you need to prepare an area to receive them. There are various ways of doing that. And then once you've achieved that, it's, you know, the sky's the limit, essentially. A lot of people live on a very small area, and that's okay. Doesn't matter. You can still put in a few things. The other challenge is that a lot of people live within a homeowners association or a condo association. There's all kinds of unsustainable landscaping rules, if you will. And so it's going to take people working with their homeowners associations to educate the group and realize that acres and acres of closely clipped turf grass aren't going to do it in terms of a sustainable landscape, a life-giving landscape. So I would encourage you, if you live under the auspices of a homeowners association or a condo association, and you are inclined to do better in terms of landscaping, it's time to start working with your group. It can be done. There are a lot of people who will come and educate your group, and you got to put just one foot forward and keep going.
Dr. Doug Tallamy.
I often tell people, and it depends on where you live, the easiest thing to do is to plant a tree. Mm-hmm. Most people have more lawn than they need and fewer trees than they should have. So then the question is, which tree should I plant? And that's a very good question, because all trees are not equal and all native trees are not equal. One of the things we've learned is that just 5% of your local plant genera are producing about 75% of the food. I call them keystone plants, and you really want to make sure your yard has one or more keystone plants. In I think it's 84% of the counties of the U.S., oaks are number one keystone plant. They're supporting more life than any other tree species. As you move further north, so certainly northern Wisconsin, you're going to move more into conifers taking over that role. But oaks and native willows are really important. So, you know, plant that one tree and then think about the area under that tree. If it's lawn right up to the tree, that's a lost opportunity there, because that's a good way to reduce the area of lawn, is to create a bed around that tree. It also provides the ability for the caterpillars that develop on that tree to complete their life cycle. Most of the caterpillars on a tree fall from the tree and complete their life cycle. They form a pupa either under the ground or in the leaf litter under the tree. And if you have hard-packed turf grass under your tree, they can't get underground. There is no leaf litter to form a cocoon. So even if you have an oak and you're making lots of great caterpillars for those chickadees, they're not going to be able to complete their life cycle in a typical yard. So creating a bed where you have some ground covers that you're not going to walk on, your native flocks, or, you know, there's dozens of species that make nice ground covers, provide a really, really great place for these caterpillars to complete their life cycle. And then you have your little thriving ecosystem right in your yard. And it all started by just putting in that one tree.
You do talk a lot about the keystone species, and I've heard you talk about the amazing benefits of even just having one oak tree. I think oaks, depending upon the species and what area of the country you're in, support anywhere from 400 to 500 different species of caterpillars alone. So if you can only do
557 in my yard.
Wow. That's amazing. I mean, that's truly amazing. So if you can only do one thing, plant an oak tree. And really, there are oak species here in Wisconsin for just about every habitat. You know, if you have a wetter area, you can plant a swamp white oak. I mean, they're lovely and their bark is so interesting. So if you can do just one thing, put in some oak trees or even one oak tree.
Yeah, and I want to talk about kind of for the renter. Right, there's a lot of, especially in my age group, people who don't own homes. Are there public plots of land where you can still be involved, or organizations where you can still get involved? For those who maybe are not at the home ownership stage, how can they get involved?
Easily. There are lots of different places you can volunteer your time and your energy and your enthusiasm. So, for example, I mentioned our local chapter of Wild Ones. We certainly have other things going on. Root Pike Watershed Initiative Network has a number of habitat restoration projects going on. And right now, you know, our newest one is the Pollinator Patch Program. And we can always use volunteers to help do things like plant the plants, weeding out the plots, you know, monitoring what's coming up. Good photography is always helpful. There's just so many different places. Your local nature center can use help, whatever. It might be a woodland area that needs addressing. I mean, there are so many opportunities for people who are renters who don't have control over their own landscapes to volunteer their time and their efforts. And of course, you know, if you have a good relationship with your landlady or your landlord, talk to them about putting in something. You know, a tree would be easy to manage. So, you know, there are a lot of different ways to do it.
Great. Dr. Doug
Talman. Yeah, I certainly second that. The problem for invasive plants is just enormous.
Yeah.
And 86% of them are escapees from our gardens.
Wow.
But they cover, there's almost no acreage in the country that doesn't have an invasive plant problem. So on private property, you can say, all right, it's the private landowner's responsibility. But on public property, nobody... You know, they just throw up their hands, oh, who's going to do this? So volunteers are critical. That includes most roadsides. It includes most public parks. It includes most of the natural areas that don't have nearly the resources or the personnel to control these things. I think of these plants as if they are tumors, ecological tumors, that just continue to grow and grow and grow. Because that's what they are, and that requires a lot of hands to keep them in check. It's doubtful we're ever going to eliminate any of them. And a lot of people say, well, it's not worth fighting them, but I counter that. It's very worth fighting them, because we need to recreate functional ecosystems, recreate the specialized relationships that drive our ecosystems, and none of those occur with these invasive plants. So, you know, 82% of the country now lives in cities. That's a lot of people, but they all can get out and they can be active in our natural areas.
Right. What you were talking about is you mentioned sort of people losing heart. I certainly have met a number of people who are, you know, in the trenches, as it were, fighting invasives, and they lose heart because it is such an enormous problem. But especially now, as we are trying to survive the ravages of climate change, resilient landscapes are ever the more important. And I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about climate change and the impact on our native species or not, but if you'd like to, please go ahead and chime in.
Okay, yeah. Climate change is another enormous environmental issue. And the ultimate solution to climate change, those solutions are going to be found in the polling booth. I mean, these are policy issues mm-hmm. that require global change. And the individual gets, you know, does feel helpless. Well, there's nothing I can do and change the direction of climate change. That's not really true. You can contribute to it, but I understand the feeling of it being a bigger problem than you can handle. I don't talk about climate change a whole lot because all of the issues I'm discussing are issues whether or not we have climate change. We're destroying habitat, and we're not thinking about enhancing local ecosystems. And whether there's any climate change or not, that's a huge problem. But in putting the plants back into the U.S., in converting that 45.6 million acres of lawn into a planted area, you are helping climate change. By planting that tree, you are helping climate change. Plants pull carbon out of the air, and they fix it, and they build their bodies out of it. So if you're a big bur oak, you've got tons and tons of carbon right there. But then, even more important, they pump it into the soil. The dark soils that you see, that darkness comes from carbon. And it's a very complex association with mycorrhizae and roots and glomalin and all kinds of things that build carbon into the soil. But all you need to know is every time you plant a plant with a decent root system, and all of your Midwest prairie plants have giant root systems, mm-hmm. you are putting carbon into the soil. And the soil scientists now tell us that our soils, the Earth's soils, can sequester 7 times the amount of carbon that's in the atmosphere. The key is, how do we get that carbon back into the soils? Well, we're not going to do it. It's plants that are going to do it. So revegetating any part of the Earth is going to help the climate issue. So you can feel good about that and get active in planting.
Right.
Nan, you mentioned losing heart, that some people lose heart, right, while they're doing this. And many people have 1-2 jobs, right? Sometimes 4 jobs in a household with both parents working multiple jobs, right? Mm-hmm. So how do we make sure that while people want to do this, that it fits into their schedules, right? People are living busy lives, kids going to practices and everything else. How do we make this a priority for the busy family?
Sometimes it has everything to do with restructuring priorities. So there really is not anything more important than having healthy soil, healthy water, and healthy ecosystems. And, you know, we get kind of stuck in a rut sometimes. You know, we're always attached to our devices. And I certainly will admit that I love technology. It's a wonderful thing. But technology, as long as it's teaching you something, it's furthering you, it's deepening you, not just technology for technology's sake.
You mean Snapchat is not just like, oh, man.
Maybe that's not what I'm talking about. No. So I think sometimes for some families, for some people, it's a matter of restructuring priorities. For other people, you know, if you've got 2 or 3 jobs and you have kids and you know, life is a struggle, there really isn't something more that you can do at that point in time. But for those of us who can, it's imperative that we that we join in this effort. It's for us now, to be sure, but it's also for the future. It's for the future so that, you know, when we look back, we can say, yeah, I did what I could, and I made the world a better place.
Well, I sympathize with the family with kids and the, you know, the sports events and driving here and there. It's a busy time. But we're learning more and more that to reconnect society to nature is going to start with our kids. We've got to move from Facebook to the yard that is brimming with life, so that our kids can learn to be good stewards of the planet. We're leaving the planet in their hands, and right now the only thing they know is Facebook and Snapchat, just as you said. And that's a bad recipe. Mm-hmm. So I would think all parents have the responsibility of introducing the natural world to their kids. And that's going to take some time. They're, again, restructuring priorities. But there's also documented health benefits from doing that. And there's a really good book, recent book called The Nature Fix. This was all started by Richard Liu with The Last Child in the Woods, but The Nature Fix is a recent one. And man, I can't remember the author's name, but it details the many very exciting ways that minimum exposure to the natural world improves our health, improves our brain, our longevity. I mean, real issues here, and they're studying how this happens, but it does happen. Again, as a busy parent, it's important to expose your kids to that.
Mm-hmm. You know, kids are meant to be outside for the most part. Kids are meant to be outside exploring and getting dirty and learning life skills. And Dr. Tallamy mentioned earlier how we've removed ourselves from that equation. We've removed ourselves. We're here and the natural world is the other. But in point of fact, we're 100% part of it, just like anything else is. And I can tell you from personal experience, after years at Riverbend Nature Center, when you go outside with a kid and you can have several days in a row, it's an amazing transformation. We used to do a thing called Magic Spots, and it became this sort of invaluable reward for kids. They got to go pick a place in the woods that felt utterly secluded and away from everything, and just be there. They could just sit and listen. They could draw. They could write. And years later, when young people would come back to visit the Nature Center when they were in their 20s, they remembered exactly where their magic spot was. They might not have remembered the rest of the stuff that we did during summer camp, but that magic spot meant something to them. And you know, I mean, there's nothing more rewarding than that, you know, to be able to connect someone, or I should say reconnect someone to the natural world. Yeah, get your kids out there. We have so many wonderful places, River Bend, Pringle, Hawthorne Hollow, you know, so many opportunities to do so. Get your kids out there.
Right, and you can take a piece of that and create your own spot in your own yard by planting native plants in your yard.
Absolutely. You don't have to go someplace. You can go get inexpensive little magnifying glasses, and you can crawl around out there with your kids and have a wonderful time. You know, it's a bonding experience for you and your child, but it's also a bonding experience for you, your child, and the earth. And the more native plants you begin putting in, let your kid plant a tree and watch that tree grow as the child grows. I mean, there's nothing more magical.
I want to talk about...
Just want to interject, that's a huge advantage of doing it where you live, mm-hmm. because it allows the kids to interact with nature on their own schedule, mm-hmm. at their own pace, without it being directed by an adult. If you go on a field trip, that's better than nothing. But being able to go outside and discover something on your own is a really critical part of this equation, and we need to encourage that.
I want to talk about where we can find a list of native plants. You have something on your website, Dr. Tallamy. We could go in and type in your zip code and find plants in your area and in your county that work for you.
Exactly. That's called Native Plant Finder And it's not on my website. It's on the National Wildlife Federation website. And what it gives you is a ranked list of the best plants, the ones that are going to produce the most life in your yard, both woody plants and herbaceous plants, for your county. So that's the benefit here, is that anywhere in the country, you can go to this website, and it will give you which plants are most appropriate for your county. That's, again, Native Plant Finder.
Right, and you can get to it by going to bringingnaturehome.net, your website, and you can, it's linked on your website, and you can click over to the Native Plant Finder. We're wrapping up our program here.
Darn, I'm going to have to keep going.
We have about 5 or 6 minutes left. Nan, I mean, just kind of talk about this, kind of wrap this up, and kind of the steps that people can take. They've listened to this conversation. What can people do next?
The first thing I want you to do is either go to the library or your local bookseller and buy Dr. Tallamy's books. He has two of them. But really, I mean, if you really want to be inspired and rejuvenated, I think those are really good things to have in your collection. So Bringing Nature Home, the title of one of them, Bringing Nature Home, Help Native Plants Sustain Wildlife in Our Gardens, and then also The Living Landscape that he co-authored with Richard Dark. So really important parts of your native plant library. There are several other books that are really good out there. Heather Holm wrote one about landscaping for our native pollinators, really excellent book. And another one, one of our local people, our champions of native plants and the environment, Mariette Nowak, wrote a book about landscaping for birds. Those are all really good resources, especially if you love books. The Wild Ones website.
If I could mention, yes. I've got a new book coming out in February, too, called Nature's Best Hope, which is an update of everything. So I direct you to that one, too. That's Timber Press.
Excellent.
Nature's Best Hope.
So you can have three books by Dr. Tallamy. That would be just wonderful. So, again, Wisconsin is a treasure trove of really excellent resources in terms of getting started on your native landscape. And if you already have a native landscape, it's music to the choir. It's really a wonderful thing to have around. Lots of resources.
Absolutely incredible. Dr. Doug Tallamy, again from you, what are some steps that people can take as we wrap up our program this morning?
I guess they're mental steps. Realize that you are a critical piece of the future of conservation, whether or not you own land. And the more active you are, the more difference you're going to make. We have tremendously challenging environmental issues. And for most of them, it's difficult for one person to do something and see a difference. But not this one. You can go and plant native plants wherever, and you can watch the life come and use those. You can see that you have recreated interactions that used to be in your area, and you've done it easily, and then you can enjoy them. It's a positive response that motivates you to do it again and do it again. So take heart. There really is there is hope, particularly if we all get active.
Yes, I'd like to encourage everybody that's local and regional to start going to Pritchard Park with regularity. There's been a major renovation going on there, not only for prairie plants, but also in the woodland and wetland plants. We started last year. Yeah, it was last year already. And major changes have already occurred. The native landscape is young. So some were planted with plant plugs, others were seeded in. So you'll get to see this thing evolve right before your very eyes and see it come to fruition. And it's a true native oasis in the middle of a very urban area. Bring your plant ID books, bring you and watch things unfold. It's going to be wonderful.
That is Nan Calvert in her monthly visit to the morning show. And the guest via the telephone was Dr. Doug Tallamy from the faculty of the University of Delaware. And Troy McDonald served as guest host for this edition of the morning show. By the way, right after NPR News headlines, just before today's Music Potpourri, we'll hear Nan Calvert's calendar of environmental events that are going on over the next few weeks.